You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes.
As the current debate surrounding artificial intelligence grows more inflamed by the minute, it feels like the perfect moment to revisit a television series from the early noughts, Battlestar Galactica. Our guest, screenwriter and television producer Aaron Ihas, joins us for a discussion of the 2004 series, a reimagining of the 1978 original of the same title. Battlestar Galactica follows the survivors of the 12 colonies of Kobol, obliterated by the Cylons, an android race of their own making. The fleet of refugee survivors, protected by the Battlestar Galactica, the only military ship that survived the attack, launches itself on a quest for the lost 13th colony of Earth. Battlestar Galactica is a complex mix of military and science fiction drama with spiritual undertones. It explores myriad ethical questions created in the wake of 9/11. The ensemble cast explore notions of personhood and various political conflicts. So say we all.
Aaron Ihas is a screenwriter and television producer whose credits include iconic animated series such as Avatar: The Last Airbender, for which he served as head writer and co-executive producer. He was also a producer for the live-action series The Mullets and Ed. He is co-founder and CEO of Wonderstorm and co-creator of the Netflix series The Dragon Prince. He has been involved in the video game industry as well, having served as creative director at Riot Games.
Welcome to After Images podcast. Aaron Ihas, we're delighted to have you here today for a discussion of Battlestar Galactica. We always like to begin the podcast by asking you a very simple or deceptively simple question, as the case may be. Why did you choose Battlestar Galactica and what does it mean to you?
Yes, it's deceptively simple because it's that would take much more than an hour to answer. But I think there are a couple of kind of great film stories. And when I say film, like I'm thinking like series, you know, big, you know, visually told with, you know what I mean? Filmic storytelling that were just these great serials that pulled me in, that combined, you know, they were episodic, they were one at a time, but it was really an opportunity to dive into this deep, long story. And I think Battlestar was just one of them that really just elevated my thought on what was possible in serial storytelling and what you could aspire to. And like, it just had incredible world building and gripping characters. And it just took you deeper and deeper with every episode. I mean, I could go on and on about how, I mean, and my rewatch recently, like I was just became aware of like how just brilliant and master level craftsmanship went into the pilot and the first episodes. And it just, it drew me in and it had me, and then it disrupted me and it surprised me in ways that upset me and then drew me in again. And it had great themes and it had, that make me think about history and time and the future. It was prescient. I think we're at this moment where we are about to, where, you know, we're talking about AI and we're talking about what is artificial intelligence? What does it mean? And so much of Battlestar Galactica has this, is, you know, this very advanced artificial intelligence that humans are calling toasters. You know, it's amazing and it's fascinating and it's prescient and it's relevant. And I don't know, I just love it. That's my fast answer. But I'm going to think of like 80 more reasons while we talk for the next hour. So
we'll be here for them. But okay. Just for a quick question, were you watching this as it aired when it first came out, or is it something that you came to a little bit later? And I ask because there's also this context of the kind of post 9/11 show, but also this era of what we refer to now as the era of golden era for television.
And perhaps a little Second question, were you also watching the original TV series in the 1970s, 1980s when it aired?
Great question. And by the way, that was one of the other things I would have called out, which is they really elevated that source material. They did something magical and meaningful with source material that was a little wonkier, in my opinion, right? And like that may be because it was going, the 1970s version was going through the network the system at that time, and there was a little bit of, I think it was chasing Star Wars a little bit. Again, the concepts kind of combining ideas of like naming characters Apollo and Starbuck, and having, I think they had quite a few, I think there might have been an implication that they were predecessors of humanity, might have been like embedded in it. So that was a powerful idea that got repeated in the new one. But yes, I did know the original. I was a kid when it came out. I had the toys. In fact, the first generation of Battlestar Galactica toys had the vehicles, the Vipers and the Cylon vehicles had shooting red missiles, little lasers that shot. And then I think a kid might have choked on one and they pulled it back. And so then the toys couldn't have them. But I had the original ones that shot. And I remember that was a point of pride in my neighborhood. But yes, I loved the original and I remembered it. And actually, when the new one came out, I didn't see it originally live. And I was dubious at first. I was like, oh, it's a remake. Someone's making a thing. And then what happened was when I was at the time we were recording, the time it was coming out, we were recording Avatar: The Last Airbender. And I would come into our records, and the actors and the director and people like that would be talking about the latest episode of Battlestar Galactica and how incredible it was, and how, and it mattered, and they cared about it, and they were invested in it. And the conversations they were having that I was overhearing on the side were like about like, religion and, spirit. And like, I was like, what are you talking about? Really? This, it's that great? And they're like, it's that great. That said, it took me until I think it came out on Netflix in like 2010 was when I watched it. So I it was the first time I watched it. So it was still only a few years after it first came out, but I did experience it as more of a binge. But I'm very conscious and appreciative, and I guess I recognize the challenge of building a great serial story in the pre-binge era, which is because you had to balance, episodic against serial. To do both, at the time, again, pressure from TV networks was you build a franchise because eventually you're going to sell this content into a second window, and they're going to air it 5 days a week, and it might be in a different order. You never know, and like they need to be able to air it in a different order. And this was pressure that was on us on Avatar too. So I know that being able to tell a long serial story takes, guts as a writer and creator. It takes guts for the executives at that, TV network to say, okay, we're going to let you do it and find the balance. So I was appreciative of that, even though I experienced it as a binge the first time. And then my re-experiences, because this may be something you talk about as well, this is one of those shows, along with Twin Peaks and maybe a very few others I could name, that become a show that once you watch, when you find someone, whether it's like a best friend candidate or someone you're falling in love with or whatever, you're like, we have to do this marathon. We have to share this together. It becomes something you feel, it becomes such a part of you that sharing this experience is a part of sharing who you are and growing in deeper into the relationship. Anyway, I overanswered your question. I have a tendency to do
And
that.
just anecdotally, just so you know, because it did trigger my memory that last week was the last week of classes at my university, and a student of mine said, "Oh, my boyfriend made me watch Avatar as a test. When we first got together, I had to pass the Avatar test." So I know exactly what you mean by this reference.
That, by the way, like I feel so crazy that I just said that and you said, oh, this show, that it makes me feel like almost over, like just humbled and a little overwhelmed that to think that, oh yeah, people do that. They share that show as a way of getting to know each other. It's like, I feel really grateful for that. That's amazing.
The relationship to time that you've just mentioned is very interesting because it's a show from the early 2000 that is prescient about what's happening today, but it's also referring to a show from the 1970s. And at the same time, it is very evocative of the early 2000. How do you feel that it depicts the mood of the United States in 2004, 2005?
You know, it's funny. On the rewatch, I noticed some of that too. And unfortunately, one of the things I noticed was that the political conflicts between the military and the civilian government almost seem quaint now, right? Like it's almost like the current president and the current just situation is like the fact that there were moral holdups over things like elections or how a person is treated in a feels like a little quaint. And I, you know, certainly my hope is that we get past this era and people realize deeper, more deeply how they value kind of the democratic principles that were at stake. But again, that conflict between, you know, a freely elected president and you know, leadership and people still having power and a voice and things like that, you know, versus some military or executive authority overreach, was, you know, probably applying to some questions around, you know, the Bush administration and, you know, the war in Iraq and things like that, which again, in retrospect, are almost quaint now. At least that's my perspective. What do you think? Tell me what you think about how it reflects that era. I'm curious.
I don't know if I have a clear answer to this, but I think it is dealing with a variety of issues that are very powerful. The relationship, especially between the humans and the silence, I think is very evocative of what was happening at the time. The conflict between the United States and Iraq, I think, can be read through this lens, and the conflict between the polytheists and the monotheists, and the conflict between those who believe in democracy and those who function according to consensus, which seems to be the silent way of dealing with things. So, I don't know, I mean, there are many layers, many ways to look at things through the lens of Galactica, and I like that it's not that there's just not one way to see the reality of the world through this show.
It's the and I don't know if I'm even using these terms, the kind of multiplicity of perspectives and points of view, the is a powerful part of the storytelling in Battlestar Galactica, which is to say the creative the creators and writers treat all of the points of view with a lot of dignity, respect, and depth. And there are moments when they're wrong, and there are moments when whatever, but you know, you almost have to honor them and their intelligence as characters, you know, in this way for them to be real and come to life, right? Which is to say, if you don't treat a different point of view, if you only have one point of view that is actually functional and deep and resonant, and the others you can tell they're wrong, you end up with something pretty flat, and a lot of the characters become non-believable. The truth is, there are a lot of really intelligent, virtuous people with high integrity who have different beliefs. It's insane, right? And the storytelling does a great job with that. And to me, part of what great storytelling can do is allow you as a person, if you can take those different perspectives to deepen your understanding of all these different points of view and grow respect for different points of view and start to understand where the conflicts arise and to some degree maybe accept those conflicts or really start to think about how can intelligent people of high integrity and strong character find some common ground when there's so many differences. I don't know. Like there's something so powerful to me about storytelling that capably honors many points of view, even when they are in conflict. It's hard to do. It requires complexity. It requires you to embrace some, ambiguity, I guess, and uncertainty. But you, I think we become wiser, stronger, more empathetic, as a result of storytelling like that. Again, I've over-answered the question.
I think that's a very, very good answer, and I really agree with this idea that it's very difficult to figure out in this show who is good and who is evil, because there's a little bit of both in everyone, including the Cylons. The Cylons, of course, are presented as the enemy, but they were also the slaves of humanity, who gained their freedom by a revolution of sorts. So obviously they're overreacted because they basically committed genocide on the 12 worlds. But nonetheless, they had a good reason to rebel against human authority in the show.
It's interesting. I mean, yes, I like, and here's where I go a little to like a storyteller thought on this, which is like, okay, well, the genocide is just part of it's part of the premise. It's hard to get away from that if you're, because that's the story, right? It's like there's the last humans are trying to find Earth and on their way. But what they did was they built out as much of a, not a rationale for it, because you can't rationalize that. But a case for Cylon life and individual life and as entities and agents that are not toasters or machines, but are struggling with their own existence and growing into something new. So, it is incredible.
We're so honored to have an excellent storyteller such as yourself here. So, piggybacking on the theme of storytelling, I'm curious what you think in terms of the evolution of the different seasons. You've worked on series that have, a good number of seasons. So, how do you see that arc evolving in Battlestar Galactica? Do you have a favorite season in particular? Are there kind of standout moments for you, or how do you feel about that?
So I love all the seasons. I mean, I think I'd have to, I might say season one ultimately if I had to, because like that was where you first grapple with like what a be just the beautiful world building and who Cylons are and that, but one of the things that always stuck with me as unusual and brave and in a good way and a bad way, and I'll tell you also how it connects to the Dragon Prince in a second, which is when they're and I'm my brain is being weird, but where they've made the camp and there's a year-long time skip. Where does that occur exactly? Do
I think you're
you
speaking of
remember?
season three when they
Yeah,
make New Caprica.
Caprica. Caprica, yeah, and that year-long time skip, it's so funny because I'm so mad about it. And then I was so glad it happened. I was so, oh my God, this was really. So it's one of those really, to me, is like a courageous moment of storytelling in a way. And I stole it a little bit for Dragon Prince.
I know
And
exactly the moment you're
a
talking
lot of people hated it. And a lot of people hated it. And I was like, oh no, did I do something that I loved as a storyteller because it was kind of a little bold and risky and it worked? And as a result, did I shake out a lot of kind of more, I guess franchise viewers who just wanted the story, who wanted it, who didn't want to be disrupted or thrown off kilter. They didn't want that experience as part of their Dragon Prince experience. And I think I did. And part of my, and to let that go back into questions of storytelling for a moment, part of, I think, being a strong storyteller is having an awareness of all the layers of audience that you're addressing, building it for. And so, in the case of Dragon Prince, that includes younger people and families. It includes teenagers and 20-somethings who are a little more obsessed with like anime and storytelling. There are a lot of ways to characterize those layers, but I think you can also say there are kind of hardcore fans, and then there are people who just want like a good fantasy show, and they're like, "What the hell? You just skipped 2 years, and I'm confused." I don't want to work for my storytelling. So I don't know. And I'm not sure if I would have done it differently or not. And the other way I rationalize it is not just Battlestar that did it. I mean, like Star Wars movies did it. You go, but Star Wars movies were more self-contained. You know, you finished Star Wars and then you started Empire. It was years later and stuff happened in between, but it wasn't as like something wasn't as surprising about the time skip. We also played the time skip as a surprise. So in season four of Dragon Prince, we had shown Viren waking up at the end of season three, and the feeling and the expectation should have been that that was just a few days after the events of season three. And so the shock when Claudia says 2 days, it's been 2 years. It's like, I don't even know if there's a camera move, but hopefully there is. But like a dramatic camera move on Viren as he realizes that 2 years have passed. I think that maybe hit the disoriented some of our audience as well. So anyway, but for me, that was one of my favorite things and influential. But maybe I overly borrowed from how much I liked that idea in a way that wasn't didn't embrace the full group of our Dragon Prince audience. How did you feel when you saw the time skip watching Dragon? Did you watch Dragon Prince through that point?
Yes,
Oh yeah,
yeah.
we love it. But for that, well, I'll just speak for myself because I'm someone who struggles with change. So in every series that I've ever watched, at first I'm and then I think this is brilliant. But it takes a few episodes to ease into it. But I think that destabilization that the viewer experiences is something really powerful because you realize what an impact it has on you and how you've really conceived of this world, like how you've integrated it into your viewing habits, how you think about that place and that time, and then everything is kind of thrown up in the air. And in a way, it reminds me too of how it really divides viewers. Still, the question of the character of Dawn in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I don't know if you've ever watched that, but this
Yep, all the
character.
way through. Yep, another great serial story. Yep, that great example.
Right. So this kind of throwing a wrench into the plot and kind of us having to reimagine context is so powerful.
Yeah, that's what I find very interesting in such a device. It's the fact that you have to figure out what happened in between, to imagine what happened to these characters to reach the new level of stability at which they are standing when you start the story again. And so much can have happened in between that it creates some tensions that are not only directed towards the future of the story, but also towards the past, to the in-between moment that we've missed. And I think this is very powerful.
And we're not spoon-fed. I mean, we have some freedom to imagine as well. Like we're putting the pieces together, and that's really powerful and interactive.
And that's the other element that I like very much, is that it drags the viewers into the act of storytelling itself. We're not passive anymore. We are made to be interactive with the story, to try to figure out what happened. And this is something that really triggers this a lot.
So I think in every case, Battlestar and then also Dragon Prince, yeah, I mean, there's a moment where you're like, hey, what's happening? And it takes you a few episodes to find that groove, but it's such a powerful moment. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I, part of what I am hearing is like, you're challenging the audience to engage their imagination in the gaps that they have to fill in. And I love that. And that's exciting to me. I at the same time, the thing I'm aware of, and this is another balancing act that a lot of storytellers have to find, because you're telling your story with based on the good graces of the TV network or studio or whoever is paying for it, and you maybe can keep going or maybe not, depending on whether you succeed and enough people watch it. And I think in the old TV model, where you had a show on every week, at a certain time. And then that's when, like, if they changed the time slot, that would screw up the audience. All these things happen. You were fighting against these kinds of problems. But, your goal was to create some momentum and some word of mouth. And, like, this week at 8, we had 2 million people show up at our campfire to watch our show. And maybe they went and told some people. And hopefully next week it's, 2 million 100,000. And then the next week, more people and more people showing up at the campfire at the same time every week at 8 o'clock, right? And, in those days, whether, shows like Cheers and Seinfeld weren't hits out of the gate. what happened was there were executives at these networks who had creative instincts and courage and said, this show is good. And if we keep going, it's going to get better. And they're going to keep telling people, and the group of people around our campfire of storytelling is going to grow. And often it was like 2 years of commitment. It was in the third season that it actually started to gain momentum and suddenly would go from 2 million to 25 million. It was like, suddenly these shows became hits. And that was the old way. And so there was sort of this like mitigating force of the like executive who believed that could kind of keep the show going until the show grew. And now, we have these new opportunities to tell serial stories, but because it's not weekly, because it's a binge, what happens is you get your number on day one, generally speaking. And let's say it's 8 million people show up for your campfire. And what happens is by the end of the last episode, by the end of the binge, it's down to 6.5 million. 1.5 million have gotten up because they had to go to bed, because there were other campfires. They just only 6.5 million made it through that season. And what happens is your next season comes out 9 months later, and basically it's that 6.5 million who show up for season two. And 5 million make it through to the end. It's start to have this, and it's just the way it works. So it's harder to create this word of mouth without like a weekly experience. In my view, it is harder. Now, Dragon Prince was in a rare, somehow something happened, and in our season three, we did grow. The show grew, and more people showed up, and we were really lucky. And that m kind of miracle is why Netflix, that miracle, and by the way, also a courageous executive who said, I believe in this, and it grew. We're gonna invest in more seasons. And that's how we got the opportunity to tell a seven season story. We have more seasons in that story that we are trying to tell, and we're very much on the cusp right now. So we're fighting to get that going. One of the things we do have is we have an audience of millions of people who really love The Dragon Prince. And so we are going to be kind of telling them what we're planning, what we're thinking about, trying to engage them, trying to build energy and expectation around kind of the next part of that saga, so that we can find partners who can help us build it, which, hopefully is Netflix. And so now I'm saying too much about it,
No,
but it's
no.
more just a commentary on how kind of the old model of TV and the new model of TV. I think there are new opportunities for serial storytelling, but there are also the new model. It seems like it's going to have less multi-season storytelling. So you can be more serial, but there's going to be less multi-season experiences because of just the way people are consuming the content and the way that works. So I don't know. For now,
Well, perhaps
one more thing on that topic. I want to say one more thing. Unless a courageous executive realizes there's catalog value, and that is to say, hey, when you have these shows like Friends or CSI or The Office that have found an audience that love it, there's something magical, and they last and they continue to create engagement and hours on an ongoing basis. There's a really powerful long-term value when you create something with a multi-season catalog. So hopefully there are executives somewhere who are like, let's take some risks. Let's go that extra third or fourth season on some things that might be dipping right now, but they could come up because they're just that good that it's worth investing in. It's worth building a long-term catalog. Anyway, that's what I hope happens.
But it's so interesting what you said about the season three growth, for instance. Do you have ideas about how do you attribute that growth in addition to the support that you had from an ally and an executive? How do
I
they
mean,
attribute that growth?
this is my grocery. Yes, I think that in the history of hit shows, this is very, very common. I think there is a combination of a team finding their creative footing and stride. And when I say team, I mean the writers, I mean the actors, I mean the characters and the story and the world. It's series type storytelling where when you watch these shows, Game of Thrones really found its, pace in maybe season three. And like, by the way, they had books to base it on, right? But still, something about everything gelling, it gelled after three seasons. Cheers, Seinfeld, other examples. I mean, I remember reading at some point that in the history of TV, I think there are maybe only two shows that like were just like number one right away. And I think they are The Cosby Show and Laverne and Shirley. And Laverne and Shirley was arguably a spin-off from Happy Days. So it just jumped in and it was number one. Everything else found an audience, found its pace and then became a mega hit, right? So there's something about hit shows creatively finding a stride and finding an audience and creating momentum that, if you look at it, I think has taken three seasons. Well, this is a problem for Netflix, in my view, because their model right now says, well, we get a certain number of viewers in season one, and it goes down a little bit in season two. And so usually we won't make a season three. Well, it's a rational decision, except that, 80 years of television history says the big hits tend to be born in season three. So the big hits tend to be born in season three, and they're cutting everything off at season two. That leaves you without those mega hits, and they can still have things that have a lot of viewers and a lot of eyeballs, and that's what they want, right? They want the viewing hours, but those big hits are the ones that last. They have catalog value. They matter for f decades. They have con it's content that has value for decades. So again, Ted Sarandos, when you hear this podcast, you gotta like empower the executives at Netflix to find shows that have enough creative value that they believe in, that it's worth taking that third season risk and seeing if maybe the third season is where it grows instead of dipping. If we had only made it two seasons, I don't think Dragon Prince would have gone to seven. Thankfully, we did make it three seasons. Whether they regret that or not, I don't know. But they should give more shows that third season chance to see if they can grow.
Do you think this tendency could or should perhaps change slightly the way stories are told, so that perhaps the seasons function more independently from each other instead of flowing one into the other?
Yeah, I mean these the can you rephrase the question so I can answer?
What I mean is that traditionally there's this idea that season one leads to season two, leads to season three, and so on and so forth in a linear way. Perhaps the new way that Netflix, among others, are thinking about TV series could lead to a different conception of how to juxtapose the various seasons so that it remains sort of the same world, but perhaps going into different directions, a bit like what you've done with this 2 years gap that makes it a different series in a sense while being the same series.
I mean, it's a great question, and I don't know where what Netflix is finding or or learning or discovering or believing. I know because we've been involved with Netflix since 2015 that their views evolve. They're trying to learn, they're trying to figure it out. In the early days, there was definitely a belief that it needed to be very serial, very cliffhangery. We need a harder hook on the end of season one to drive people to season two, and I think that's definitely true episode to episode, where you want those, you want something cliffhangery to get you to binge the next episode. You want to already be like, oh, let me just watch the first 3 minutes of the next episode. That feeling, and part of that is because they want to drive. If you start with 8 million, can we get 7 million, 7.5 million to finish instead of 5 million, right? And if it's got those cliffhangers and you're moving people through, great. What I don't know, to your point, Franck, is it better to have just like a strong ending that is satisfying, and then you come back for a new story next season, or a little bit refreshed or new, having a great feeling, or do you need that cliffhanger? And I don't know. But I imagine they're forming some opinions about that. So, I don't know.
But these questions of how technology is shaping our livelihood and our perception and the way that we live today, kind of reminds me of Battlestar Galactica in terms of especially.
Well done, taking it back to Battlestar
But no, it really did remind me.
Galactica.
You know, there's all this talk today. Of course, you mentioned the link with artificial intelligence today, this concept that some people think, you know, we're just kind of shooting ourselves in the foot, like we're destroying ourselves. I have to ask you, what do you think of the ending of Battlestar Galactica when all technology is destroyed and they basically go back to the kind of level of primitive man to live with the other humans that they have found existed on Earth?
But is it, the implication is that we are now the descendants. This is a big spoiler, anyone. We're now the
We're
descendants of those
pro-spoiling.
Cylons and the so-called humans from the original, right?
Yes.
They've merged, which is weird, because I guess the technology has somehow now been integrated into how they've been configured. I mean, I liked it. It definitely was, like, to me, like the most thought-provoking and heart-moving pieces of the series were not necessarily the ending, but I know endings are very hard, and I liked it a lot, and I thought it was a big, ambitious way to finish and stick the landing. So, I liked it, and I liked kind of the flash forward and looking at the magazine or whatever, but endings are really hard.
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
But
What did you think? What did you think? Did you have mixed feelings? I feel like we're in case you're listening to the pod when you're listening to the podcast, we're communicating over a Zoom, so I can see your reactions. Maybe you have questions over the ending or feelings about it.
I was a little disappointed, I guess.
Okay.
I think, like you, my favorite season is season one.
Yeah.
I'm hardcore. You know, I'm a hardcore fangirl of like really good exposition and world building. So, like you, I think season one is so fantastic for that. And then we've got this brilliant cut in season three that takes us through to a different time period. Lots of things have shifted. And then I don't know, the ending felt a little cloudy for me. I mean, as always, very thought-provoking. I feel like every episode in Battlestar Galactica could be an ethics class, just in terms of all the different subjects that it raises. So from that point of view, you know, it stayed true to its form in terms of really asking a lot of questions. But there were a few things that maybe felt a little easy in terms of throwaway for a technology. Yeah, kind of went onto a more kind of spiritual bend that maybe wasn't quite what I watched the show for. So, yeah.
It seems to me too that the show was very progressive in a sense about its depiction of artificial intelligence, in the sense that it was willing to give personhood to the Cylons,
Yes.
to treat them as real beings capable of having a conscience, and they were the equals in a certain sense, morally speaking, of the humans. And all of a sudden, at the end, they give up on all sorts of technology to come back to a state of nature, which I think contradicts what had been said until that point in the show somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense, but I thought that I really liked the fact that I mean, I'm neither for nor against artificial intelligence. I think it's a very complicated subject that requires a lot of very careful statements. But what's for sure is that I do believe that it is possible for artificial intelligence to reach personhood. Just like I do like the fact that in your shows, there's all, very often animals that are treated like persons.
Or multiple species,
Or
this
multiple
question, or
species. And this
people
is
get
something I
on.
really like about what you're doing. It's not just humans that matter, it's also the rest of the sentient animals. So I guess that the end of the series was a bit disappointing from this point of view, because all of a sudden it was somehow saying, that's too dangerous to deal with this. Let's come back to just being humans and in nature.
Yeah, I'll, you know what? I may watch it again and contemplate. I definitely, you have, look, this show turns me into a geeky, obsessive fan so fast, and I love it. And it's just, and then you kind of come out for these moments of like, oh, what am I learning? Or how are they making this? And you kind of think of it as a storyteller and a writer as well. And so, For whatever reason, yeah, something about the ending takes me a little bit out of being the geeky fan, a little bit more into like empathizing with how hard it is to end a saga like this and tie up all these loose ends. And by the way, connect it to our world and reality. So there's certainly parts of the ending that I think are deeply brilliant and beautiful and have incredible scale. But I definitely hear the parts that like maybe don't gel as well with all the themes you were thinking about and engaged with, and maybe seems to move away from them. But wow, it's hard to do that. And I know I was impressed with the scale of it, all the implications of it.
And just so many narratives to wrap up, right? I mean, in terms of what's happening with different characters, their relationships, I mean, they really packed a lot in because I remember up to that final episode thinking, how are they going to answer, all these different questions? There's no way they can. But they really gave it their all to, really give us a true kind of ending for everybody's unique storyline.
And you know what? There's something else to it that's interesting too, which was in the original series that they kept to in this ending, which is this kind of notion that this is actually history, that it's even though it's sci-fi and it's future, Adama, like the suggestion is that maybe this is First Man. This is somehow the story of Adam and the starting of the garden or whatever, and like all of those aspects, which again are just like teases of names that get passed down, that trickle, that through storytelling and evolution and repetition and iteration they change and evolve, and that's how our stories and culture works, right? It's sort of interesting. A random thing that it reminds me of is a book called Ridley Walker that I remember reading. I don't know if you know it. And I don't actually, I'm not sure if it's really good, but certainly when I was 15, I thought it was really good. It was like brain changing good. And it's written in like almost a different language. Like language has evolved. And there are all these little hints of like things in their myth and their storytelling. And then I can't remember how soon you put together, what they're talking about, that it's actually more contemporary than we realize, the story, and refers to things that are currently happening. But anyway, I appreciate that kind of meta awareness of storytelling and culture and kind of how things change as they're being iterated and evolved, and it intrigues me.
There's definitely a feeling of deep time that you feel at the end of the series. And that connects, I think, with the idea of ancient aliens, this idea that the Earth was visited before time by other species, except that in this case, it's these other species happen to be our ancestors. They happen to be the ones who are going to become the Greeks and the Romans with their mythology. And the conflicts that they are going to face are the same that are going to erupt around the year zero with monotheism happening and the silence being akin to a certain extent to the Christians and to the Jewish people. So I think it's very, very subtle the way all of this is integrated inside the mythology of Galactica. What did you think of the spiritual side of the show? How did you position yourself?
Yeah, I mean it's counterintuitive in a cool way. I thought that like, oh, the Cylons are the more religious ones, right? They're the ones who are somehow, instead of being like cold technology that is just like science based or whatever, they are the ones who believe in the one God and fate and destiny and all that. So I thought that was consistently pretty interesting. But also just like a note on that, like little world building aspects, like, when they say, so say we all, like being like amen, which I think means comes from all men, or I'm 100% sure what amen comes from, but you forget that like, oh yeah, there's a word here that has become just like the thing you say at the end, but it was once something. So I don't know, little world building that are cool. But yeah, Yes, it does end up feeling like, yes, the humans actually have a, you know, yes, the polytheistic and shallower mythological religion they follow versus the, you know, more fate monotheism, all powerful. It's an interesting exploration. And what I can't tell, now that I think about it, is like how much the idea of like prophecy and religion ties into ideas of like all this has happened and all this will happen again is like that those r repeating patterns and cycles, is that a function of like time and culture and kind of beings that kind of recycle themselves and their stories? Or is there an implication that there's a force guiding everything? But it's but I but it does all connect in an interesting way.
There's definitely a tension between science and religion in the show. I mean, it's a science fiction show, but nonetheless with a very strong religious element. And the tension between the two is interesting because you definitely have elements that are not within the realm of what is scientifically is possible. And this is also to be put in relationship with the fact that the humans are also abandoning technology as a whole in order to first fight the silence because they don't have any AI on their ship so as not to be pirated by
Or detected.
detected
Yeah.
by the silence, and they end up
Yeah.
giving up science as a whole at the end of the show. So there are, I think there's a lot that can be said about this part of the world building.
And on that note, I'm just curious if you've ever watched the prequel spin-off show Caprica, because it delves so much into this question of monotheism versus the well, this question of religious because there's a monotheist kind of marginalized group in the series.
You know, it's I did watch it. I haven't watched it as recently, and it's not on the list of like must share with potential spouses and stuff. And I loved it. I recall it ended before its time. Like it didn't.
I think there was just one season.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I did think it was you know, I enjoyed it. That's all I remember now is I enjoyed it, but I don't remember
No, same. We're
anything
watching it
else.
for the first time now. I
Yeah.
think they're like.
Where are you watching it? What channel is it on? I need to watch it again.
Oh, we have it on DVD. We're physical
Oh,
media.
okay. Got it. Got it. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think that it's not a must for Galactica fans, but it is interesting because it really does dive further into that religious question and kind of explores that origin of the conflict between polytheists and monotheists.
And the other thing that I find interesting is the fact that Galactica is very much a space show, whereas this one is set on Caprica itself, which also leads me to remember the fact that Galactica is a military show. It's very much based on the army, on the de depiction of the army, whereas I think that Caprica is
Yeah,
much more about
civilians.
feelings, civilians. And all of this connects with the role of women in these worlds, which I find very interesting, especially in 2004, the fact that you have a president who is a woman, the fact that Starbuck becomes a woman. What is your take on on these elements of the
The
storytelling?
gender.
And it's funny, it's more of a controversial issue today than it was then. So I think, you know, and I'm kind of careful navigating this. And the reason I'm careful actually is because I think great storytellers seek wide perspectives and wide, and this is a word that is a little loaded now, representation, but not because of political reasons, but because they're seeking to have multiple points of view because it creates depth and dimension in storytelling when you have that kind of, again, the word representation. I don't know the better word, but it's like different kinds of people. It's a greater creative opportunity,
Yes.
you know? But I see the point of view. I've seen stuff with quote unquote forced representation that feels doesn't feel right. That's not the case here. Actually, in some ways they leaned into some stereotypes, right? The president is a woman, she was a school teacher, and that's perfect because, and by the way, she was like 25th on the line of succession when everything happened. Because you want everything to be like, she doesn't deserve this. Everything about the, military authority point of view should be that this president was not elected. She is a teacher and was 25th. She's not even a like politician or a civic leader in a traditional sense. She was Secretary of Education, but she is the outcome of the people's voice, of democratic system, of representing civilian, government versus someone who came up through the system of following orders and not listening to, a democratic voice. So, but yeah, so I don't think I'm fully answering your question, but I think the show is progressive by any standard, and but it's really just a side effect of seeking creative greatness through characters that are dimensional and different and have different perspectives. And if you do that well, it's just a side effect that there's representation because you have different points of view and voices in different places. Anyway, that's how it's a little bit.
It's not progressive for the sake of being progressive. It's just that
No.
good
good
storytelling.
storytelling that is also, it happens to be progressive.
Yes, and very often when something is progressive, and you can feel the agenda if someone is pushing too hard, and it loses depth. It becomes shallower instead of deeper. When that happens in a way that's not kind of creatively biased, when it's a politically biased, not creatively biased. But yeah, when it works well, it's creatively so powerful. And then, but when it's contrived, it's not, doesn't work as well.
We've talked a lot about storytelling today, and I'm curious to know if there are aspects of the visual storytelling, the filmmaking itself, that you appreciate. To my mind, this Battlestar Galactica, the 2004 version, is more based in a kind of hyper-realism documentary style than you might think of when you watch the older 1970s version. So I'm just curious what your take is on the visual aspect of the show.
I'm going to turn the question back on you in a minute because I'll say just what my experience is, which was that the choices they were making were telling the story. I mean, to me, it's like, I don't, I, that's as a storyteller. And I talk about like when I think about like craft or something moves me from being a fan to being a, storyteller. There are some shows where I'm like, that move me into like producer and I'm like, oh, I see why they did that. Or they had to save money by doing this. Or, oh boy, they spent a lot of money doing that. It's never felt that way. Like there were the moments that were spectacular. I thought there are some choices around special effects, at least at this stage, 20 years later, that to me are artful and classic, which is to say it's not going to age. And that's not just a great special effects person, but strong directing and show running where someone is understanding how style and technology interact, and that you have to make sometimes when you choose style over technology, you make something more timeless, and they've made that choice again and again. But to me, the real core thing is the visuals emphasize the fantastic acting. And the camera's in the right place to see how brilliant this cast is, which is something we haven't said earlier in the conversation. And to me, that's also a great part of the storytelling. Probably, the writers are thinking not only what's this great epic story we can tell, but how can this phenomenal cast show up and feel excited to stretch and show their range and reveal and do these things with, their faces and movements and like the writers are clearly writing opportunities. The cast is taking advantage of those opportunities and the cameras are capturing it. And when that works, the humanity just like pours out onto you. Like while you're watching it, you're just like, oh my God. So to me, that combination, when you have the writing, when you have that incredible acting, and then the storytelling is just letting it breathe, is the way that I get captured. So That's how I see the visuals. But turning it back on you, turning it back to you, excuse me, I would love to hear your thoughts on the visual storytelling and how that, especially because that's, I feel like that's more your expertise and wheelhouse than it is mine, is the how that compares to other cinematic stories.
Oh gosh, I'm not a specialist of science fiction, even though it's a genre that I love, but I 100% agree with you. I think what really impressed me watching it recently was how well this series has aged. I mean, there are so many other series that I love, and it doesn't matter to me that the aesthetic, I can tie it to a specific time period. That can be interesting too. But in this case, I feel that it's aged really well and that, new younger viewers wouldn't necessarily, feel kind of alienated from it in terms of not being able to relate to that aesthetic to fall into it. And yeah, I think it's really great as well because it is this kind of hyper realism that you see that's really been the filmmaking choice. And at the same time, that's hard to do in a way that doesn't become dated very quickly. And that might also be that might relate back to this idea of the fact that it is a vintage ship and it's got its own, color palette. Like when we see a newer ship that comes in to the show, we can really contrast the fact that it's darker, more somber, has maybe more metallic elements, whereas this older ship has got the older big gray boxy computers and certain colors I think that we already associate with maybe more vintage technology. So I think that was a really smart choice. What about you?
I had the feeling that they found a really good balance between the show being a military show, but at the same time having very strong relationships between the characters. I mean, you really feel for them as human beings. Their relationships are really as important as the military conflict that is opposing the humans to the silence. As for the filmmaking itself, I have the feeling that for the scenes of fighting, they use a lot of fast zooms to give you the feeling that all of a sudden some cameraman saw something and really wanted to zoom in on what was happening, and handheld camera. And I was wondering if perhaps that was not like a reminiscence, perhaps, of what was happening at the time with September the 11th and with the war in Iraq, this idea of being plunged inside something happening in front of your eyes and being caught on camera.
Yeah, I totally see that. The camera definitely does a lot of the work in terms of having you, letting you feel the surprise and the action and the danger, and it's really great.
But I'm so glad that you brought up the acting because it's such an ensemble show. I mean, what a huge ensemble Battlestar Galactica is, and the kind of multiple chemistries that you find between different pairings on the show, and the way that things are constantly being mixed up each season in terms of new friendships or new alliances that are being formed. I mean, it's just incredible. Very, very, adaptable cast that really evolves over the four seasons and then the subsequent films. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that because it really is just such an admirable cast. I don't think I can really point out any one person who seems weaker than the others. It's just such a strong overall cast.
Yeah, no, I almost want to start naming names, but it's like there's just so many great actors and bringing, incredible performances, and like yeah, I'm sure they get told that plenty at conventions and things like that, because but they deserve it. They deserve every bit of attention and love they're getting, because they really made it real. And that's, you're in space and there's, crazy weird stuff happening. So to be a part of that story and still feel so deeply human and real is an active challenge, I think. Anyway, it's really great.
As we're getting closer to the end of this episode, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little something about what you're currently working on.
We are, my partner Justin and I are working to see if we can make what is the third arc of the Dragon Prince. And I think in time it will happen. It's just, it is a question of finding that convergence of, audience, creative energy, and resources to make it the way it needs to be made. So we're working on that. We are working on some other interesting projects that, our projects tend to have a combination of some spectacle and action mixed with character and world building and emotion and stuff. So we like that mix. So we're trying to work on a couple of new projects. I'm also finding a little bit of like a, you get to a stage in your career where because you can get paid to write, you spend a lot of time pitching. Here's a thing I would like you to pay me for to write, and then finding out if they'll pay you. And then you let the check writers choose what you're doing creatively. You realize, oh, wait, over and over again, I'm letting that happen. And so again, like the continuation of Dragon Prince is something we really care about. But a lot of the other stuff we're working on is working with other producers and executives to find a project we want to do together. I kind of want to find something that I want to just write. like I'm at a stage and maybe that you just go through cycles, but where I want to find that thing where 2 or 3 mornings a week I can just take, 2 or 3 hours out of my day, go to a coffee shop and write my own project just so that I can not sell it one day, but so that I can finish something that is probably a little riskier, a little outside of my, you start to have like a reputation and something you're known for. I mean, when you put together like Avatar and Dragon Prince, you can probably even see it as like, well, there's animated storytelling that, has younger audiences, but also wider family, and it's mature, but it's still aimed at families. Well, I don't know. Like, I sort of am interested in writing a movie about, an alcoholic struggling with his challenges, but not leaving Las Vegas. My own version of that, what I understand it is, or something. Whether that's the example, and I give that because I recently watched The Lost Weekend, which is a Billy Wilder film from the 1940s. I just, it's one of those things where it's just so simple, but it's just polished. And it's like, there's a reason Billy Wilder is Billy Wilder. And I'm sure I'm undercrediting, all the other writers and people, but like, they're just moments of brilliance in such a simple story. And part of me was like, I just want to write something that maybe doesn't have as much magic and, robots and stuff, and just has that, but it's still, so anyway, I don't know. That's what I'm working on. Mostly stuff for money. And then I want to find something personal to work on. And I haven't found it yet.
Maybe one final question to link your
Yeah.
own work to Battlestar Galactica. I mentioned earlier how much the question of various ethical dilemmas are brought up in Battlestar Galactica, but I also see, this coupled with excellent storytelling and of course entertainment as well, but there are really, really fundamental ethical questions that come up in both Avatar and The Dragon Prince. Do you feel that Battlestar Galactica was influential in that way, or is that just an interest of yours that, maybe also shaped your taste and drew you to Battlestar Galactica?
I would say I had not seen Battlestar Galactica when we were writing Avatar. So it was not influential yet. It was definitely influential on Dragon Prince. And I was drawn to it because of some of the, yeah, because it's that type of multivalent, if that's a word, storytelling. Maybe that's the opposite of univoke. I'll tell a story which I've told before, but about Avatar, but that helped me understand as a storyteller what I wanted to do. There's an episode, I think it's called The Waterbending Scroll, where Katara, who is struggling to learn waterbending and sees, she's always, she's special. She's the waterbender in her tribe, and she's going to teach Aang waterbending. And like, then he's awesome at it right away, which by the way, is a feeling we've all had that like, there's something you love, and there's someone else who's just a freaking prodigy, and it's like they don't even appreciate it. But anyway, she ends up, she steals a scroll from these pirates because she wants to learn waterbending. And the network had a problem with this episode because no one said in the end, stealing is wrong. Someone has to say stealing is wrong. And And stealing is wrong, by the way. I want to be clear. I agree. Stealing is wrong. But that made me aware that the reasons we were doing it were partially Katara had been kind of a goody-goody for a lot of episodes. And we wanted to see, as a character, what can drive someone like her to do something a little wrong. So part of it was pushing and prodding and understanding where her character goes and when she would do something a little wrong. And then part of it is understanding where someone like that might steal, right? She's feeling she's got to save the world. She's feeling competitive and jealous. It's complicated. The people who have it wasn't theirs. They stole it from someone in her culture. You know, there are complicated things. By the way, I'm not saying I don't know whether it's right to steal from pirates. I actually don't know. I don't care. I know stealing is problematic. I think there may be cases where you could justify it or rationalize it. But what was interesting is seeing this character go through that thing. And to me, on some level, I think you come away maybe going, oh, I understand why stealing is wrong. I also understand why some people may be driven to steal. Maybe some people are just evil, or maybe some people have needs that aren't being met and they're desperate and they're driven to it. And I see that it creates complications and conflicts and problems in their life when they do it. And so you don't need to say stealing is wrong, but you do need to give it an honest, authentic look at what happened and why and who the characters are. So that became my model for never having a moral, right? You can do strong moral storytelling by being true to characters and by exploring moral issues, but I don't think you end up in a better place when someone says stealing is wrong, because I knew that. We knew that from the Ten Commandments or from maybe G.I. Joe at some point, learning is half the battle. But maybe if you watch someone like Katara go through something where they steal, you understand it is wrong, but also you have some empathy and understanding of why it happens. And maybe that helps you change. You know, I mean, that's what I'm more interested in. And so connecting the dots, like that experience and that push and pull with the network. And eventually I think we had to say something like, stealing is wrong unless it's from pirates. I don't know. We had to do some stupid line or something, which is fine. They didn't make us, you know, do a lot. And again, to Nickelodeon's credit, they really empowered us to tell the story we wanted to tell, and it shows. But yeah, that experience helped me understand how to do moral philosophical explorations, which is to say, I'm not here to give you the answers. I'm here to have the characters explore the truth and push and prod, and all of us get deeper together. And maybe you can come to the answer and tell us what you found. But hopefully we've just gone through something that explored some truth in an interesting way.
It's
I
really,
don't know.
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm done. Sorry.
It's really well woven into the story, and I think this is the best way to proceed instead of having someone hammering down on you some moral truth come from who knows where. And this gives flesh and
Shape,
dimension and
yeah.
shape to the characters themselves, who are complex, who become human beings, and life is complex, and we have to deal with these issues, learning from our mistakes all the time. And I think that's probably the best way you've chosen to deal with that.
Yeah, those are where we find opportunities. One of the things I'm proud of is in season four, Ezrin gives a speech where Ezrin is a very idealistic character, and I love that the speech he gives a speech that's supposed to be like, you know, oh, we're all coming together, and Zadia and humanity are, you know, now that I'm friends with, you know, the Dragon Queen and everything's going is peachy. And he instead ends up acknowledging, because there has been some vandalism and some experience with his audience, that there's pain, that there's been wrongs, that there's still something to overcome, that there's still healing that has to happen, right? And he, you know, so hopefully you try to get to a place where he's this idealistic character who's carrying quite a bit of like hope and idealism, but you hope that over time he's able to acknowledge more deeply the reality of pain and the challenge of overcoming it in the process of forgiveness and healing. I think on our third arc, we really want to see that because, you know, we'll see Ezrin go through some things. But But yeah, like those moments where we don't necessarily have the answers, but we see some truth in some conflict are opportunities in a way to do good storytelling.
Well, such beautiful examples. Thank you.
So we usually like to close the show by asking our guest if you think that there's a question we haven't asked that we should have asked.
There something you wish we had asked about Battlestar Galactica?
Yes. Let me think. We touched on it, which is its relevance today and moving forward as something that is timeless and important. And I think there is something about it. So to ask that question is, why is it relevant? Why does it matter? Why will it continue mattering for years and years to come, which I think it will? I mean, obviously, the exploration of AI as a entity and as a potentially competitive or even adversarial entity is really important that we're thoughtful about that. I think we see AI emerging. I don't know the answer of whether ultimately, and I don't think the Battlestar Galactica writers did either, whether they're just really advanced toasters. No, I do think they did know the answer. They didn't consider them to be that. At a certain point, the things being processed and the thoughts and the self-reflection, they became real entities. I think that's what was the intended feeling. And I don't think we are there with AI today. I think right now we're at a point where it passes Turing tests. But I don't know that it passes deeper philosophical tests about personhood yet. But it may be coming, and it's something we have to be aware of and probably open to, certainly if we want to be ethical, moral beings. But also, since we're playing a role in shaping the evolution of these entities or entity, I don't know. I'm not sure, but it certainly is almost like educational. Someone should watch Battlestar Galactica if they want to think more about AI and what's coming next and what we should be thinking about. I don't know.
Well, hopefully it won't lead to the same sort of
Right. Well,
catastrophic consequences that we can see in the show, but it is definitely a question that is very powerful for our time, especially in the arts, also with creative AI that is causing a lot of problems for script writers and film directors and all other creative people. So, I mean, I think it's going to take time before we can find solutions to the conflicts we are
yeah.
seeing today.
Well, you've been so generous with your time and your answers. We love chatting
Oh.
with you today, Aaron. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure, and I enjoyed diving back into yet another rewatch of Battlestar Galactica, and what a great conversation you both host here. So thank you for having me as a part of it.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.